Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM with Gillette. When we show our best side, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
Game on 2FM.
It's Wednesday, the 6th of May.
Coming up today, some bad news to start, I'm afraid. No inter-county action until at least October.
Seamus Kennedy, 50-50 ball, comes back. Jason Ford, laying the ball inside. Good work here by Niall O'Mara. He's never scored a goal until now. Brilliant goal.
So with very little GAA action, Judy Murray tells us how you can inspire your kids to play tennis.
I think, when the boys were little, I started out as a volunteer coach at Dunblane Tennis Club, really to get out of the house, to get a bit of fresh air and a bit of activity.
And our weekly legend is a man with possibly the longest job title in Irish sport right now, the FAI's interim deputy chief executive, Niall Quinn.
Probably bending free kick, gets the ball in, Niall Quinn goes for the win! His 35th birthday with the record goal for Ireland, his 21st international goal, and Niall Quinn is the record all-time Irish goal scorer.
All that and much, much more between now and 7 o'clock. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Now, I'm afraid I'm going to have to start with further bad news. Unfortunately, Killian DeGaskin, who was supposed to be on with us, isn't able to make it. He has, at the very last minute, been called into a very important meeting, which I'm sure he has plenty of them. So hopefully we'll get him on later in the week.
Marie, I did about 4 hours of study on zero prevalence. I can't even pronounce the words I was trying to study. It's that technical, but I'm disappointed we don't have him. I hope you yourself and Donny can get him later in the week.
Can you send us over the cog notes?
Yeah, no problem. I have enough of them. I have half a rainforest here in front of me. I have that many notes. But it is disappointing. I wanted to know a lot more about the zero prevalence study that Neffet want to do. And look, it would have been interesting.
Well, he probably, maybe he heard you were doing so much work and it put him off coming on.
I'd say he was more afraid of you now. Your reputation is going in front of you at this stage.
All the hard questions. But there is some good news. Germany, Ruby.
Germany's back to Bundesliga. The Germans can do it all, can't they?
Well, they're very efficient, as we might have said once or twice before.
We have indeed. Somewhere along the way, sports are going to have to move forward and get on and try and inspire people. We heard Kevin Doyle talking about it last night, and I think, the Germans are going about it. Now, look, obviously their testing seems to be a lot more efficient than ours, and maybe they're in a better position to start it. But it'll be interesting to see how they fare out and how they get on the spread, spread-wise, I suppose.
Yeah, well, while we have good news with the Bundesliga, we have bad news with the GAA, and Damien Lawler of RTE Sport joins us now. Damien, you were quick out of the blocks with this story. You've been covering it all day. How has it developed that there will be no inter-county games before October?
Good evening, Marie. Good evening, Ruby. That basically the last few days, a lot of people have come out, Marie, even going back to John Conlon on your own show a couple of weeks back. And everybody's kind of given over their own views. Players, managers, referees, David Goff as well on Game On. So plenty of views coming out, plenty of stakeholders getting their views across. And there was an increasing, I think, kind of gauging of the mood in Croke Park that they probably wanted to maybe get some clarity and maybe kind of take the temperature of the room and get some information out there. So a series of phone calls today, a series of teleconferences with county board chairpersons across the board, and probably going on all morning in Croke Park. Rumours had abounded last night that A, maybe the championship was going to be scrapped altogether, or B, that everything was going to be downed until October. So I suppose what's transpired today after probably days of conferences is that people are trying to stay positive, first of all, as Ruby alluded to. People want to try and get to a stage where you can get out and play sport. But to factualise it, all GAA activity is restricted now and grounded until July the 20th. After July the 20th, club grounds will open up again. It's hoped, if all is going well in society, that training can resume at some level at that stage. It'll be club level first, no doubt about that. All GAA activities being grounded for the time being at the county level, that's important to specify, because county boards simply, apart from the health and safety factors, can't cope with the economic and financial factors of personnel around teams, and that has to be capped as well. But it's hoped that a championship, as I said on the show all along, a championship can be run off in 9 to 10 weeks if it needs be. And it's hoped that providing the virus has eased off or burnt out or is under control, a championship could be run off from September, October onwards, possibly even with a landmark around Bloody Sunday, and that in consultation and monitoring all that's going on around us and in consultation with the governing bodies, a championship could be held in October and run off and not even need to go to 2021. One thing's for sure though, Marie, at ground level, there's no appetite for a behind closed doors championships. So they're looking to try and maintain inter-county championships in 2020. They're also looking to try and get club championships up and running before that. So that appears to be, from the outset, the overall look from today.
Damien, you say at ground level, there's no appetite for behind closed doors games. Who is ground level? What is ground level?
Well, I suppose from today's perspective, Ruby, ground level is county board chair people.
So this is a financial call from county boards that are not prepared to have these games and there's no gate receipts?
Well, I would feel that the cost of, personally speaking, the cost of staging the games is probably pretty high, pretty severe. And if the gate receipts aren't coming in, then could it cripple the association even worse? And I'd say the answer to that is probably yes. Like, at the best of times, Ruby, it takes about 35,500 people for Croke Park to even break even on a match day. So that's an important factor that needs to be realised as well. So
one can imagine that, but surely you could play in smaller stadiums where it doesn't cost as much to open them.
Yeah, you could do, but I suppose, I mean, at the end of the day, like, for example, if you're caught in a jurisdiction thing up in Ulster, for example, whereby the Northern Ireland Assembly is doing one thing and the Republic of Ireland government is doing another, well, then Clonus will become probably a central venue there. So that maybe takes away your options thereabouts. All-Ireland finals traditionally are held in Croke Park, no doubt about that either. I think really, though, what are the GAA about as an association? They're about basically building on crowds and community. To be honest about it, I think that's a huge thing there. That's not to say that things won't change over the coming months, but certainly taking the mood from the floor today, that there is no appetite at the moment for behind closed doors games at county level.
Damien, and just before we let you go, you do have a very special day there at home. What's going on?
Yeah, the little fella's 9 today, so I've been trying to cram in a little bit of attention for him, Marie, as well, along the way. But look, at no more than your own kids and Ruby's kids. I've seen Ruby down at ladies' football matches for kids as well in Kildare. And we all have kids who want to go back and play. It has to be done in a safe manner. You know, from July the 20th, there is now hope that club games could potentially, a few weeks after that, take place. And Marie, I know counties have already put in place systems to play games behind closed doors, picking out 2 venues within a county. They're floodlit. Players will not be togging out in dressing rooms. Temperatures will be taken. I'm still not sure about the social distance when it comes to contact sport, and the GAA have said today they're looking for further clarity on that. But I think in many ways they're going to sit back now and see how the situation unfolds and see how other sports cope with their maybe baby steps back to action as well. And that's not a bad thing either, Marie. It gives people room to breathe. And I don't think they want to make a decision now, and there is pressure out there from some quarters to make a call, and then maybe in 3 months' time, if things have changed, feel that, OK, we might have made the wrong call here.
Damien, thanks so much for joining us now. We are also joined by Clare football manager Colm Collins. Colm, just from a managerial point of view, what's your reaction to this news that there will be no inter-county games before October?
Firstly, Marie, I think it's very important that we finally have got some clarity. I think that from the players were really roaring out for this, and you know, it was very difficult for them to have nothing or no guidelines whatsoever, so that although it came late in the day, it's great that we got it eventually.
Damien mentioned that just a minute ago, that there wasn't really much appetite at ground level for games behind closed doors. What was your feeling on, what is your feeling on that, Colm?
Well, of course, I mean, it seems from my own initial thoughts on it were that I'd rather have behind closed doors than nothing else, if it was the last resort. But the more I think about this and the more players I talk to, I don't think there's an appetite for it. And I would say that as long as, if there's any danger to players, I wouldn't be for it, no.
I can well understand, Colin, nobody wants to be put in a dangerous situation or be made something they don't want to do, but I would have thought maybe for the love of the game, people would have been keener to play behind closed doors.
I that was my initial reaction, Ruby, that, yeah, if it was the last resort, yes. But the more I'm talking to players and the more I'm listening to what they're saying, you know, and different situations. I mean, you know, players that are have got people in their circle that have got problems, like an older person with COPD or maybe a child with cystic fibrosis or something. These players are very conscious of the dangers here, so that you know, I would respect whatever they decide. I would go in behind, definitely.
I respect their decision too, Colin, but all of those people that we're talking about are going to have to go back into working environments at some stage too. So where will the big difference be?
Well, the big difference, I suppose, Ruby, is that in work, it's your livelihood. You know, that I think because of the way GA players have, you know, behave and train and are so dedicated, the one thing that I think people are missing is that they're not getting paid for this. This is not, they're amateurs. So that if my livelihood was as a, for example, a soccer player, well, then that would be an entirely different question. But this is not their livelihood. And while I would dearly love to see inter-county games and to see them going ahead, but it's very important to distinguish here between what your livelihood is and what your pastime is. And if I have to go to work because it's my livelihood, I'll take all the precautions in the world, but I don't have to play.
Colm, with clubs coming back first and being prioritised, it's kind of hard to differentiate between what's right and what's wrong with that, because when you look that there's over 2,000 clubs in the country, and if they all start coming back at the end of the summer, that's a huge amount of players that are going to be out playing together and interacting and going back to the cities that they live in and the towns that they live in. Would you be comfortable with clubs coming back?
There's the thing. You know, a lot of this area is kind of uncharted territory. And at the moment, it's very difficult to see how that's going to work. But, you know, everything is changing, and, you know, as things are developing, maybe that we'll you know, if things improve and we can find a way, great. I would dearly love, more than anybody would love to see games played, but the last thing I want is that any player is put in danger, or any of their extended family is put in danger by a pressure to play.
Colm, I know it's a long time away yet, October, November, but the realities of playing a championship in October and November, it doesn't seem even aesthetically appealing to be watching championship games at that time of year. Do you think realistically it's something that could work when you take in weather, grounds, kind of, you know, just our whole climate situation, and of course that things might not have changed?
Yeah, it's again, Marie, it's not ideal. Nothing is ideal, but these are strange times, and there's something being fired at us that nobody could have envisaged that would be fired at us, or nobody would have envisaged that we were going to have to live through. So, you know, we're going to have to make the best out of that situation. And if it means maybe, you know, coming out watching games in inclement conditions, it wouldn't be our first time.
That's for sure.
I think we'd handle that. We'll handle that.
I can tell you from a horse racing point of view that climate change definitely has had an effect, and ground is taking an awful lot longer to get soft in the winters these times. So October, November, you'll be just fine, trust me.
Yeah, the biggest problem with horse racing now is of course, that it's getting the correct ground to race on. You know, that it definitely is a factor. And, you know, since this started, we've got some such amazing weather, like absolutely amazing weather. I remember in Like, we were outside sitting, having something to eat on a patio, and we weren't even in May. So the climate is, it has changed, no doubt about it.
It's incredible.
Cullum, you're also the father of intercounty players as well. So from their point of view, like, I think especially when GAA is such a huge part of their identity, injury aside, it's probably the first time where they haven't had it in their lives. Podge and Sean, how are they coping?
They're coping well. They really are. There's been a lot of, you know, interaction. There's been some great work done here at club level, as in, you know, where they're, you know, these Zoom calls and quizzes and stuff and the interaction. You know, they had a FIFA tournament and stuff like that, and that was good fun, and it kept them together. Like, it's important. I suppose one thing that's quite clear, it seems that these guidelines have been adhered to strictly from the start. There's been no, to my knowledge, there's been no, you know, nobody breaking these guidelines, and that anything that's going on is very much for the mental health of the players, and it's a good thing. Which, the one thing about the announcement today that surprised me was this thing about disbanding the groups for, I don't see any need in the world to do that. I think that's misguided. I think that what's going on at the moment is just basically, you know, a group of people who want to be together and have put a lot of time into being together, interacting, and I think it's a very good thing. So that I wouldn't agree with that directive at all. And the other one that I can't understand whatsoever is the closure of grounds. You know, closing local pitches, forbidding two people from kicking or pucking to each other. I think that's ridiculous. I think a runner is allowed to run in these conditions. A cyclist is allowed to cycle. So what's the problem with two guys pucking a ball or hitting a ball up and down a pitch? That just, I don't get this. I think it's and this cop out about insurance drives me bananas. Whenever anyone wants to hide behind a decision, it seems to be the way to go.
Oh, sure, it's the soft way out. But if you want advice on how to train yourself and puck or kick the ball, anything you want to know about playing on your own, just listen to Judy Murray. She's up next. She gave us all plenty of ideas of how to do it all on your own.
How to do it on your own.
Cullum, just finally before I let you go, so what do you plan on doing now with your squad for the foreseeable, really?
Well, we're ironically, we had a scheduled management Zoom call tonight. So I suppose without preempting what we're going to do on that, but I still think that, you know, there was no pressure. We weren't doing anything like putting pressure on players to do anything. What we were basically doing up to now was we're available to them. If they needed anything and anything we could help them with or interact with them, we did. So I can't see a whole lot changing, to be honest about it. You know, most of these people choose this lifestyle because it's what they want to do, contrary to what some of our high-profile pundits say. It's something that's it's a lifestyle choice for them, and I don't think that there's going to be much change in the way that they operate their lives from here on in. I think they'll still do their best to keep in tip-top shape and do their best to be in the best possible place when eventually we get a resumed play notice.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they'll all be ready, as we will be when it does come back. Cullum Collins, thanks so much for joining us.
Game on 2FM.
Olympic gold with an ace. How about one more here?
Any point will do.
Yeah. Game, second match, Murray. The waiting is over.
6-4, 7-5, 6-4.
Andy Murray is the Wimbledon champion, and you simply cannot give more.
We're delighted to be joined on Game On now by Judy Murray. Judy, how are you?
I'm doing okay, thank you. We've had an absolutely stunning day here in Scotland, and I'm very fortunate to live in the countryside. So I've been out on my bike and I'm feeling a little bit suntanned, which is very unusual for somebody Scottish.
Yeah, definitely at this time of year anyway, whatever about being Scottish. Judy, you've long been a promoter of getting more children active and making tennis a sport for all. Do you think with the current COVID-19 lockdown and how sports are going to come back, tennis can really prosper?
Yeah, I do actually think it's a massive opportunity for tennis. I think particularly for families into tennis, because, you know, through the lockdown, obviously families have been having to homeschool and to entertain themselves. So you've got a lot of parents playing actively with their kids and creating games to keep them occupied and engaged. So I actually think it's a massive opportunity for tennis clubs to create sessions for families to come down together, because I always think of tennis as being probably the number one family sport, because it's kind of 50-50 split between male and female players, male and female fans as well. You know, we're very fortunate, and it spreads across all ages as well, so it really can be something that the whole family can do together for a lifetime. So I think it's an opportunity for tennis, and I hope that tennis will be one of the first sports that's allowed to go back with restrictions, obviously, because of the distance that you play from somebody. If you're playing singles, that, you know, the court, if you're playing on a full court, is 78 feet. So I'm hopeful that tennis will be one of the first ones that it gets to open its gates.
Judy, my family aren't a tennis family at all, but my little boys, I've noticed, have started to play. I came out down this morning and they had the rackets and they were outside just hitting over and back to each other, because they only have each other now, so they're not rushing off to their trainings. Like, would you have any tips for people who are new to the sport and want to get into it?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to get into it, there are so many great, whether it's sessions or clips online on YouTube, there are so many kind of webinars and things that you can hook into, you know, to get tips. There are loads of the top players are sharing tips that are maybe more for workouts rather than things for being on the court. But I think there's lots of things that you can do at home, you know, regardless of age and stage. And of course, the first thing, if you've never played before, is to get used to handling the racket. And you can do lots of things with balloons and with shadow strokes that just get you used to the movements that are the things that mimic the movements that tennis will ask you to do. But there's no substitute for watching, you know, some of the reruns or the YouTube clips of the top players and kind of learning from them the sort of shapes of what the various shots are. And of course, tennis is one of those games where you have to be able to move to and from a bouncing ball. So, you know, practicing with if you've got a wall, that's probably the very best thing that you could do, is, you know, start off hitting the ball gently against the wall. And of course, you can do it with a bounce, you could do it without a bounce on the volley. And if you don't have a wall and maybe you don't even have a garden, you can start off with a balloon and just bump the balloon with your hand indoors, you know, against the wall. So hitting up, hitting forward, hitting down. Because when tennis was first played, it was just played with a hand and a ball. The racket came in very much later. So it's always made sense to me that if you do everything with your hands first, that mimics the motions that tennis would ask you to do, it's much easier then to put the racket in your hand and be able to do it. But you do need to be able to move to and from a bouncing ball. So anything that is throwing and catching statically initially and then adds in a little bit of movement is going to be good, and so is just shadow stroking, moving to and from a cone, for example, or a tin of beans if you don't have a cone. Lots of things you can do at home to get started.
Judy, you are heavily involved in the Judy Murray Foundation, which tries to create tennis really and other sporting projects in every community wherever they want them. Has your work been hampered much during the corona lockdown?
Yeah, it has, like many small charities and also many sporting clubs and sporting bodies. Yeah, it's we basically try to take tennis into rural and disadvantaged areas, and we focus on building workforces within the local areas. So we teach people how to get others started in tennis, you know, basically with whatever space they have, you know, if it's a school playground or an artificial grass football pitch, you know, whatever it is, we show them how to make the use of what they've got. But yeah, it's a real challenge. So one of the things that we've done, like many others have done, is we fortunately have video backup for all of our activities, and family tennis is a big program for us. So parents coming with their children or grandparents coming with their children, because in rural and deprived areas there isn't money to pay for coaching, and I'm a huge believer that a lot of the physical skills that you need for any sport can be developed just by playing actively at home. I mean, that's how we all used to learn when coaching wasn't really a thing. So big believer in the parent stuff. But fortunately, we had videoed all of our activities as backup for the people in the communities that we trained up. So we're turning that at the moment into an online course that we can deliver by Zoom, so that we can still stay in operation for as long as the restrictions and the lockdown is in existence. So, but it's a real challenge, I think, for any charities, but particularly small charities, because you have no opportunity to do any fundraising, and you can't do any activity because you can't be in proximity. And tennis is one of those games where, certainly, if when you're getting started, you work in small spaces and it requires you to play with a partner. So it's a bit tricky. So we're like everybody else. We're trying to find ways to take things online and really ramped up our social media to share lots of those games and exercises and ways you can get started with whatever you've got lying around the house. So yeah, we're staying busy, but it's going to be a challenge.
Judy, there's lots of kids who aren't going to be able to go back playing sport and seeing their friends and being part of their teams or their clubs for a long time. And a lot of parents now are going to become the coaches in the back garden. And I'm sure that's something that you were probably very familiar with down through the years. For them, though, like, any tips for trying to get your kids to focus and get a little bit out of them when they won't have that coaching for such a long time?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a big potential also for sports to capture some of the parents who have become the home teachers and the home coaches and get them involved when the time is right into assisting delivery at the clubs or schools or parks. So I think parents are probably finding a newfound respect for teachers and coaches when you're trying to work with your own kids. But yeah, I think it's going to be a while before things get back to normal in terms of recreational sport within clubs. So I think, you know, the more support we can give to parents to help them to help their kids to develop the skills, to remain motivated. I mean, one of the simple things that I'm saying to parents all the time, if the kids are old enough to watch tennis matches on the computer or any reruns that are on the television, is watch it with the sound off and pretend to be the commentator. Because if you say what you see, you actually start to be able to analyse what the players are doing, and you start to see the spaces on the court, and he should have hit it there, or he doesn't like it when you hit it high on his forehand, and he always aces him down the middle. You know, you can start to build up quite a nice little tactical understanding from assuming the role of a commentator, and that doesn't require you to have a court or go anywhere. You can do that from the comfort of your sofa or your chair in the garden if it's a nice day. And I think, you know, if you went onto our social media platform for Judy Murray Foundation, you'd find loads of clips, not just our clips. We retweet a lot of things, you know, people who have upended trampolines in the garden, and it becomes a perfect rebound net for you to be able to hit the ball to, and it comes back to you. Sheets over the washing line that you can serve into. There are endless possibilities of things that you can do to try and stay involved. You know, it's not perfect, but we've all got to learn how to adapt.
Judy, you obviously were an accomplished tennis player yourself, and then you turned coach of your two sons when they were younger. But for all of us parents trying to teach our kids how to do something, and you did it quite successfully, how did you manage to motivate and train your own children?
Yeah, I think it is a challenge. I think one of the things that I learned from my kids when they were very young was that they don't want to listen to you, and they don't want to be taught by you, but they do want to play with you. So it actually formed the basis of my coaching philosophy many years later, that it's all about inventing the games that do the teaching for you. So, for example, one of my favorite games would be pinata, you know, the kind of party game where the kids smack the pinata and they smack it until the sweets all drop out or whatever is inside it. So, you know, I would create a pinata with ripped pieces of newspaper, a plastic bag from the co-op that ripped quite easily, and a bag of covered sweets. And I would hang it on my tennis racket and I'd hold it up high enough for them to hit at full stretch with either their hand or their tennis racket. And actually what I realized that it did was that it actually completely mimics the motion that you need for an overhead or a serve. And they have no idea. They just want to get the sweets out, and they won't get the sweets out unless they hit it pretty hard. And that means going faster with the racket. But the game makes them do it, not me telling them, you've got to hold it like this, and you've got to have both arms at the same time, you've got to tuck it behind your back, you've got to reach up as high as you can go, and then you've got to pronate and whatever, you know, all these kind of big words that little kids don't understand. So it's about, if you understand what tennis will demand of you, and even in the most simplest form, just the shape of a forehand shot or a backhand shot or a volley or a serve, you can actually find things that mimic those motions. I mean, playing badminton is a great one for tennis players to help to develop their overheads, because almost all shots in badminton require you to reach up to the shuttlecock. So, but I think for me, I think when my kids were about 12 or 13, I realized that it's much more important to be the parent than it is to be the coach. And they were really pretty good by that stage in terms of junior tennis. And so I brought in a young coach to work with me, who was very cool, very good looking, played very well. And, you know, all the kids in my squads thought he was the dog's bollocks in a way that I would never be the dog's bollocks. But I mentored him. He started with me when he was about 20, and now he's in his early 40s, and he's the head of men's tennis at the LTA, and he's the Great Britain Davis Cup captain. So, but I think it is tough to coach your own kids, but I think the key is to keep it relaxed and actually to make it just feel like you're playing with them. And we all know that kids learn best by copying, so if we can do good demonstrations or mirroring of what it is we're trying to get them to do, they will actually copy you without you having to say anything.
Judy, I think you have given us all a lesson of how to entertain and keep our children some way fit in the coming weeks. Thanks a million for taking our call.
You're welcome. It's nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Judy.
Thanks, Judy.
Bye. Game on 2FM.
An introduction for our next guest. Every Wednesday we have a legend, and tonight's legend is Niall Quinn. Niall, you're very welcome to the show. How are you keeping?
I'm great, Marie. Thank you. Brought a big smile to my face there with the music belting out there. That takes us back.
I think it takes us all back, especially in these very strange times. We need something to give us a lift. And at the moment, because there's nothing on, we are kind of relying on nostalgia and old commentary. But it definitely works. But Niall, the coronavirus is kind of hitting us all very hard. I've seen you doing some skills online, and I'm going to be honest, you needed to do a little bit of work. Have you improved?
I have. I actually posted my improvement there at the weekend. But unfortunately for me, I've learned a thing or two about marketing. That didn't work very well. Nobody wanted to see me do well. But they really enjoyed the fact that I couldn't do it when I started. But hard work, perseverance, Marie, even at 53 years of age, I'm vastly improved now because of the Home Skills Project.
Getting you back into shape, Niall, and keeping you going. But I mean, you say at 53 now, but when you look back at your career, I mean, the longevity of your career was phenomenal.
I got 20 years out of it, Ruby, thanks. And I went over there as a kind of a hurler who had a chance to become a footballer, and I was a little bit I suppose, happy-go-lucky about going on trial in the first place, because I hadn't played a football match in about 3 months before I went on trial. So it was a career that didn't come out of, you know, thousands of hours of elite performance practice to get on a ladder. It just happened, and to get 20 years out of it was quite incredible. So some great memories along the way. A couple of relegations and a couple of operations. You've had hundreds of them, you know what I mean? But, you know, all in all, I'm very grateful for what I achieved.
It must be the first time in your life, Noel. It's definitely the first time in a lot of people's lives. We were just talking to Colin Collins there, where there is no sport, there is no training to go to, there is no match to watch, and people are missing it. What are you missing most about it?
Well, that's a great shout. I suppose the build-up to matches, I think watching them is fine, but the talk and the chat and whoever's playing at the weekend, whatever the big game is. And I suppose, you know, personally, since I got involved with the FAI and we got the first few games in, it was a difficult winter, you know, particularly with the change around that had to happen at the FAI. And then we got going with football matches. There was international matches coming in the summer. The League of Ireland was starting. We had that fabulous match up in Tallaght between Shamrock Rovers and Dundalk. And the juices were flowing. The women's football team had a great win. I went to that as well. I went to see Bowes and I'd seen Pats. And the whole thing has just come to a halt. And as I was starting off my FAI League of Ireland type association, so I missed that. The rest of it, I suppose, the drama of what's happening, the Liverpool story, you know, whether you're a lover or a hater and how that was going. I mean, they were just phenomenal this year and what they were doing football-wise. And then at other ends, you know, even Sunderland, poor old Sunderland and the trials and tribulations. We get a bit of that on Netflix now with Sunderland Till I Die. But, I just miss the fact that we can spend time wondering who's in the team of a particular match, wondering what formation they're playing. And I suppose that the live buzz of a crowd and the reaction to goals, challenges, and then it spills into the next day when everybody talks about the game afterwards. All that's missing at the moment, you know.
I agree with you, Niall. And look, horse racing is a minority sport in this country, and whatever way you look at it, the League of Ireland doesn't have many household names either. But with the GAA kicking the championship into October, do you see this as an opportunity for the League of Ireland to grow, to expand, to get itself up the pecking order a little bit?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a different thought going on at the moment, Ruby, in that it's a very worrying time for League of Ireland clubs. And as an association, we recognise that, and we're trying to find as soft a landing as possible in this terrible time for the clubs. And we're coming up with a couple of perhaps acceptable solutions, we don't know, because there's a real issue with us that the GAA don't have, and that's the payment of players and the livelihood of the footballers who actually play, who make it a full-time job for themselves. So trying to find a way that can carry on and that they don't all get laid off. As you know, probably you'll have seen, some of our clubs have had to do that already. And to get back playing, you know, the players will have to get fit again. They'll have to know that they'll be in a medically safe environment. And we'll have to have some reason financially for the clubs to bring it all together. And it'll all be decided, you know, as well as ultimately on what, you know, our HSE have to say and our government have to say about when we'll be allowed back. But it is worrying and our choices aren't great at the moment. But we do hope that there's a will out there that people would actually watch League of Ireland games if we got them out there, you know, safe medically and out there to the people who are starved of sport at this moment in time. There's also an international audience that we could look at. And it does bode well in that the conversations we're having with not just streaming companies, but marketing companies and global marketing companies at that, that there would be a future for the product, whatever happens when we do come out of coronavirus. So it's not something to be sneezed at when we're, you know, sort of putting stuff out there for the clubs, because it may have some long-term value as well. We just hope that there will be enough of an underwrite, if you like, that the clubs will see the value of coming back if and when HSE allowed to happen, you know.
Colin Collins, who was on earlier as well, mentioned that there was kind of a relief because now they know it and they know where they're going. Now, for the League of Ireland clubs, when do you think they're going to know where they're going and what they're doing?
Again, it's the government and HSE who really decide that. The phases of opening up and lockdown that were announced on Friday lead us to believe that the amateur game can get back around about the 20th of July. But does that mean training together on the 20th of July to build up for some time to a later date to play? And again, Leo was very adamant that this could change at any time. If there's any sort of spike, it'll all get stopped again. So we're tentatively looking at what those dates meant and those announcements meant in the phases, and we're working with, in the first instance, Alan Byrne, Dr. Alan Byrne, our medical officer, our chief medical officer, is even this evening, I know he's talking to HSE officials about what it means for our amateur game and what it means for our professional game. And I you know, there's a big worry out there. We wrote out to all the clubs and asked them to give us their feedback on what they think of potentially playing behind closed doors and what it would mean to them. How difficult would it be? And there was a big concern about medical safety of players. And so we're looking at how we can intervene with that. You know, if we moved the games, for instance, into one stadium as opposed to all of the stadiums, could we have a professional medical outfit that could come in and do a job that would satisfy our players and satisfy everybody who had to be in the stadium? Would that be the way forward if we all had it in one place and the games were played in a neutral venue? These are things we're looking at, things that that may help. But ultimately, it's the, you know, the HSE and government will decide if we can actually do that at all. And, you know, if people are going back to work even at that time, or if people are on buses at that time, it really is, you know, it's just not football on its own here. It's society in general. And rather than be selfish and think just about us, you know, we've got to follow orders. But we do hope that the clubs can find or salvage some sort of contingent way forward that that keeps us going and gets the ball back to normal in time.
Now, we did bring you on to talk about your career, and we are going to get there very, very shortly. But just something you mentioned there that I want to pick you up on, that some of the clubs aren't too keen on maybe going behind closed doors. What happens if you can't get all the clubs to agree?
Well, you know, we have to look at it, and if they're not going to do that, then that's fine. If we don't have enough of the financial, enticement for them to come, and they're not certain about, you know, the medical standards and what could happen there, because a lot of the clubs have just volunteers and they're a bit worried about their volunteers having to administer responsibility on that side. So we're trying to remove all that before we say to them to make the final decision and come up with a number that we think is affordable for the clubs to have. And if that works for them, great. If it doesn't, you know, we just have to move on and wait probably a little bit longer to get back and when it returns to a normal time. That could be a long time down the road, as you know. So that's a plan B, obviously. In relation then, I suppose, to you know, the four clubs, for instance, who'll be asked to play in Europe, if football has kicked off back in Europe and we haven't got going, but we're allowed, yet the clubs won't play, then we have to look at those four clubs and see what we can do for them and how can we prepare them to be ready for any European club football that might take place. We're led to believe August, September, October, if that's when those rounds, first round games take place. So there's a number of things in play here. And I suppose what you're learning now, Marie, is there's more questions than answers at the moment.
Niall, we did say we talk about your life and we have started at the end of it. So we'll work our way back rather than forward through it. But in 2012, you did become director of football in Sunderland. Was the business of soccer, which you're in now but started then, was the whole business around it something you were always interested in?
Not really, no. I actually finished up in Sunderland in 2012. It was 2006 when we took the plunge. The Drumville Consortium backed me in the first instance to go in, have a look and see would it be a worthwhile investment. The Celtic Tiger was roaring at the time, if you remember. And it came by accident, really, because the old chairman, Bob Murray, and majority shareholder, asked me to meet him for lunch in London to tell me that the club was in dire straits and that the charity wing of the club, the foundation, which had been set up to help, you know, school kids in and around the Sunderland area, that was in big trouble. And could I come in and could I bring anybody in that might save the foundation? That the club was in big trouble, but he didn't want to see the foundation get into the same trouble. And so it started off with a conversation about the club charity. And, of course, Ireland being Ireland at the time, by the time I spoke to a few people who were gutsy about it, we put a business plan together. Some great people helped me. Dennis Brosnan was one of the first people I spoke to, great famous Irish businessman. He'd been involved in Manchester United's sale to the Glazers, and he explained to me how you go about buying a football club and what I had to do. I wouldn't have got anywhere without Dennis Brosnan. And then the guys from the Drumville Group came together. Some of them are well-known, Charlie Chalk, you know, Louis Fitzgerald, brilliant supporters of what we were trying to do. You know, we had other people Patsy Byrne, great man. I won't name them all here, but they were just brilliant people who said, go on, go for it. And people bought into it. And I think the moment, the crowning moment of it all was when we decided, okay, we're going over the line here. Who do we bring in as manager? And there was a few names that were in the air. And then Roy Keane's name came out. And what I was delighted, and it was Sean O'Ryan, actually, one of the Drumoville group, who said, now, that's the story. You two go and kiss and make up. And even if you don't, pretend you have. And let's get this show on the road. And it worked brilliantly. And we got great support. And Roy will tell you himself, it was, as a manager, or since he finished football, it was his best times. And, it was something that happened by accident in many ways. But, I look back, it was a good time. And the club got on well. They spent a lot of time in the Premier League. And didn't end too well years later. I think, a couple of years ago went down. And they've gone down two divisions now, but it was an amazing experience. It was hard work, and I defend the owners now and people who give stick to owners of football clubs, because half the time you can't win. It's a tough old gig, you know.
Now, the career you had was pretty extraordinary, and I think when we look now and how difficult it is to make it and look at what you did, that we really see how you excelled. But your talent when you were a kid, was it? It must have been extraordinary, was it?
Well, I tell you, I was tall and I was athletic. And so what happened, I found out in primary school early on that if you're good at hurling, you can make all the teams. So I was in second class and I was getting picked out of school to go off and play for the sixth class hurling team and the fifth class Gaelic football team. So I was kind of missing my homework, and sports was the brilliant thing in my life. And when I went into secondary school, I played for the under-18 soccer team in second year. I played for all of the GAA teams and hurling and Gaelic football. So I was never doing any homework. But I played all the sports. I wasn't zoning in on one. And I think, I look at it now and I know, sort of the way academies work now and the progress for elite athletes. You have to zone in on one at an early age and get thousands of hours of tutoring and practice in the one sport. But I think I learned more. And I don't know, hurling and... in particular hurling, but the Gaelic football, I think it taught me something that I would never have learned in football. And A, yes, one of those things, A, is being tough and taking knocks. But B, also the value, I suppose, in, the parish, playing for the club, wearing the crest. I lived my professional career. I had two moves. I moved from Arsenal to Man City and Man City to Sunderland. And I bought into all clubs like I was joining a GAA club. I wasn't on a journey to get rich quick and let my contracts run out. I had that GAA in me, and I think it was a vital component, because I suppose when the going got tough, I was able to deliver, because that would be expected of you on the hurling pitch.
No, you obviously sprung into my life when you scored against the Netherlands in 1990 in the World Cup, and Quinn the Eskimo became the song we were all singing. But you played in Euro, you were at Euro 88 as well. Must have been great times under Jack Charlton and the Irish team.
Yeah, they were. And Jack's birthday is coming up. He's 85 soon, and we're all sending messages to him. I look back now, it was definitely a time, and it was just amazing. We couldn't believe it all. And it's probably now even, you think even more how great it was. It was incredible that the atmosphere that he built up, not just between the players in the dressing room, but how he linked it to the people. He was a kind of a man of the people, and he just melted into people's hearts. And, my mother had a picture of him up beside John F. Kennedy and the Pope in our kitchen, and I think we weren't the only ones around the country. And so for me personally, to be part of that journey, I can remember getting the shout for Euro 88, and it was huge. I wasn't in the team at Arsenal, and I was on the plane. I was one of the players on, and I couldn't believe it. And then we're playing England, the most famous game of all, and he brings me on with half an hour to go. So, to be on the pitch that day, I'd have settled for that in a career. That's where I was in my international career at the time. I was a young kid trying desperately to get in, got a chance to play against England. Ray Houghton scored the goal, had that great header. Chrissy Moore wrote about Joxer. I got a mention in that song. It was just extraordinary. And then to sort of run that out and to find that 14 years later I'd be in in a World Cup match out in Japan, or it was actually in Korea where I knocked the ball down. Was it in Japan or Korea? I can't even remember. Where Robbie Keane brought us through to the next round. And that 14-year spell was just a magic time. And wearing that green jersey, it was like it just lit you up inside. And we had some bad moments, I know, and it's not all great. But like most sports people, we always try to remember the good days.
Well, and hopefully there'll be lots more good days ahead. And just before we let you go, you're now in a leadership role, and like any time I get a push notification about Irish football, your face comes up with it. There's a lot of people looking towards you now to lead football forward in Ireland. What would be success for you in your current role?
Well, that's a good question. I think we've been in about 12 weeks or so, Gary and I, and the board has moved around. And I think in that 12 weeks, we've a number of jobs that we're carrying out in various verticals of the game, if you like. And within our own office in Abbottstown, you know, we've got the corporate governance, the finances, you know. Then there's the international setup, which I think has gone smoothly, in as much that we've managed the handover from Mick to Stephen Kenny. We've brought in a succession plan there. And what I mean by that is Jim Crawford and John O'Shea, who take the 21s, that's following on from a way of playing that takes place under that age group again with the other international young teams, and we're bringing it through to the senior team. So effectively, we're backing Stephen Kenny to manage the Irish team, but we're also backing that system to create an identity that will float right down through the international setup. That will, I hope, and Stephen Kenny does in time, will see teams in Ireland, schoolboy teams, schoolgirl teams, all wanting to emulate the way that our teams are playing.
Well, Niall, I think that is the perfect place to leave it on, because we are all looking forward to football coming back again soon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Not at all.
And hopefully we'll talk to you again soon. That's all we have
Cheers,
time
mate.
For tonight.
Game on 2FM.